Greetings and welcome to The Fuse, the podcast of Confluence Concerts. My name is Larry Beckwith. In this, the first episode of a new season of podcasts, I'm delighted to be speaking with the gifted Canadian guitarist, singer, songwriter, and producer, Colin Linden. Colin is playing a couple of shows at Hughes Room here in Toronto on October 10th and 11th, one on his own and one with his longtime bandmates. We'll talk about Colin's early years as a musician, some of the great musicians he's had the pleasure of collaborating with, and a whole lot more. Colin Linden, my guest on this episode of The Fuse. Hello and welcome to a new season of Confluence Concerts and of this podcast. I'm recording about a week and a half before our first concert of the 2025-2026 season, curated by Patricia O'Callaghan and entitled What is Divine? Those shows are coming up on September 27th and 28th at Heliconian Hall, featuring Trish Subhashankaran and myself from the Confluence team, and special guests Mariam Toller, Greg O, Waleed Abdulhamid, Mayree Demings, and Bijan Sipanji. You'll hear more about the show a little bit later in the program. And I'll also tell you what's in store for the rest of the Confluence season. Of course, there's still plenty of time to subscribe and join us for all the fun. Just head over to www.confluenceconcerts.ca for information and tickets. Many of you out there have probably attended concerts at Hughes Room in their new location on Broadview Avenue, just south of Girard. If you haven't, it's a lovely spot, great acoustics, comfortable setting to hear great live music. And as always, the folks at Hughes Room have a wonderful lineup of musicians playing most nights. Coming up in October, on the 10th and 11th, you can have the rare chance to hear the phenomenal Canadian guitarist and singer-songwriter Colin Linden, one night on his own and the following night with his bandmates John Diamond and Gary Craig. I had a chance to speak with Colin recently, and it was an absolute joy. I think it's fair to say Colin was a child prodigy, and had an early intense love of the guitar and country blues music in particular. He met and got to know Howlin' Wolf when he was 11 years old, studied with some of the finest guitar players in Toronto as a teenager, and began working with the likes of Rick Danko, Garth Hudson, and Levon Helm of the band in his 20s. He's since gone on to record several beautiful albums of his own material, as well as with the supergroup Blackie and the Rodeo Kings with Tom Wilson and Stephen Fearing. He's played with many of the world's great musicians, including Bob Dylan, Bruce Coburn, Emmylou Harris, and T-Bone Burnett, to name just a few, and produced hundreds of records from his home recording studio in Nashville, Tennessee, where he has lived for several decades now. He won a Grammy in 2020 for producing Keb Moe's album Oklahoma, and here in Canada he's been nominated for 19 Juno Awards and won 9. He's been described as a musician's musician and a genuine and wonderful person. Colin Linden, welcome to The Fuse.
Great to be with you, Larry.
This is a thrill for me because I have been enjoying performances of yours and recordings of yours, I think, since I first heard you. And I think that's 40 years ago now. In Toronto. I still remember it vividly. I went to hear Mendelssohn Joe, who I knew of as a local artist and political activist. And there you were playing with him. And I really can't describe it. I've tried to describe it to a lot of people, but I think I recognized in you and in your music making a real kindred spirit. And there was something just about your songs, but also the way you made music that really connected deeply to me. And I've enjoyed your playing ever since. And so I guess my first question is, do you remember that time in your life and your career? And can you kind of talk about what the scene was like and also what you were looking ahead to doing in your career?
Yeah, I remember it vividly, and I remember meeting you back then, of course. And there weren't very many people who actually were interested or kind of got what I was doing. And I really, really appreciated your support and your friendship. It was not, it wasn't like what I did was ever some kind of sensation where places were packed all the time. Sometimes it'd go up a little bit, and sometimes it'd go down a little bit, but it was. I always felt definitely an outsider, and it was really really appreciated your support of it. And this is not so much at the time. At the time, I was just trying to. I had lots of ideas, and I was just trying to make the best music that I could. And I loved to play, so I was really enjoying that combination of doing my own music and being the sideman. Because it just enabled me to play more and to learn from the other people I was backing up and learn, it was a wonderful time that way. More so, I think maybe because I didn't have, a record deal of my own or hits on my own or anything like that, it gave me an opportunity to really to learn a lot of stuff that I really treasure still. So there's that. I think fundamentally, though, the stuff that I felt like I was kind of born to do wasn't particularly in demand at the time. I think that my background as a blues musician and especially as an acoustic, kind of country blues player that they would refer to their rural styles, 20s and 30s blues, that really got me. People didn't care about that a whole lot. They didn't care about roots music a whole lot. I mean, I got a lot of people saying, well, nobody's going to be playing guitar 5 years from now, so you better learn how to play synthesizer. And it was the MTV era, so if you were overweight, which I was, and follically challenged, which I was, and in my 20s, young enough to be impressionable, it was a hard time in certain ways. But it was also it built certain things that were really strong. The chief among them being it was the first years of my relationship with my wife. 42 years later, I'm really, I can't be more thankful for anything than that. And it was a great time in a lot of ways too, that way. Anyhow, I could talk about it for the rest of this.
Can you talk a bit about your training? Because this is another thing that I felt was interesting just in my reaction to your music making. Because, of course, I was classically trained, I had private lessons, and I was mostly a classical musician with an interest and certainly excitement about pop music. But how did you train? Were you largely self-taught, or did you have people that you went to lessons with?
I was informally taught, but I was taught, well, there were people who spent a lot of time showing me stuff. Chief among them, a guy named John Thibodeau, who still, after 50 some odd years, still a great friend of mine. I don't see him that often, but showed me how to finger pick, essentially. And what he would do is he would show me pieces that he played, and he was very methodical about how he showed them. So I learned how to fill in the blanks. If he showed me how to play at a Georgia camp meeting, Joseph Lamm, ragtime piece, it would teach me things that I'd be able to apply in different circumstances. He was great to me, and of course, a couple of years later, David Wilcox, the Canadian David Wilcox, was unbelievably gracious with me in terms of showing me things as well and showing me how to learn things. Like he would, I remember when I was about 14, we sat down with a Charlie Patton song called Down the Dirt Road Blues. And there were a couple of fun moves that seemed really challenging. And sitting down with him, we listened to it over and over again. And he would, figuring out how to figure it out really was tremendously helpful. So, and Ken Whiteley was great, and Chris Whiteley. Both of them were really, really good to me at showing me different things along the way. And over the years, there were a lot, a number of people, but those guys especially. And I practiced really, really a lot, 6, 7 hours a day for, from the time that I could kind of figure out what to do with all that time, when I had pieces that were challenging pieces to play. John Thibodeau especially was, I would come over on Saturday afternoons when I was still in school, and I was 13, 14, and I would always do my best to, by the following Saturday, figure, know how to play what he showed me the previous Saturday. I wanted to. So if he showed me how to play Dill Pickle Rag or Cincinnati Flow Rag by Reverend Gary Davis, by the next week, I wanted to be able to know it cold. So I would just practice and practice and practice till I could do that.
Has that continued? Are you do you have a kind of practice routine now as
I
well?
do. I do actually. There have been periods of time where I've played so much that I haven't been as organized with it. I mean, usually I'm pretty organized with it, although I must say in this past year, few years, I guess, but especially really even in the last 2 years, I've gotten more organized about it. And I practice a lot with a metronome, I'll tell you that. Because I play with so many great studio musicians who have just impeccably good time that I just want to, I just, and you never let that dictate how you feel the way the music's supposed to go. But having that sense of knowing where it's, knowing where it is really helpful. I remember even back when I used to. I played with Leon Redbone when I was in my late teens, and Leon was an exquisite musician. I remember him saying to me that certain kinds of songs, when you get to the bridge, if the bridge goes to a minor key, you pull it back, you lay back, and then as it comes out of the bridge and goes back into the A section, you pick it back up again. So always kind of aware of that type of thing. But I've been practicing that a lot, and I've been practicing my singing a lot. So I kind of figured that two things. I got the RSV virus very badly in 2022, and it really, really messed me up. And I needed to figure out a way to get back from that. So I a great friend of mine here, who's an incredible singer, a woman named Ruby Amanfu, she recommended a woman here who's a vocal coach, and it really helped me out a lot. So now I have a little bit more to practice with. Really, for the last probably year and a half, I've spent a lot more time doing that. I mean, I'm 65, so I kind of feel like if I'm ever going to get to be even scratching the surface of, well, just to be able to realize my own potential, whatever it is, I better damn well do it now.
I find it interesting that lifelong connection with an instrument or with a voice that I've had a connection recently with the double bass player Joel Quarrington, who you might
Oh
know,
yeah, I do.
the
I don't
Quarrington.
know Joel real well. I knew his both of his brothers better than I know.
Joel's amazing. I mean, he's a fantastic player, and of course he's been all over the world, and he's one of the great bass players. And I
Yes.
was sitting with him one night, and he's trying to get away from being so busy, because Larry, he said, I really want to learn how to play the bass.
You know, it's a really it's a lifelong job, and I mean, the older you get, I think the more your power of observation can increase. So I think that you can become more nuanced both in your playing and in your assessment of where you're at. So don't think, and I mean, obviously it's completely influenced and inspired by an absolutely undying love of doing it. I mean, that's really what it's about. But I think that there are certain things that you can actually, judge in terms of your own development better the older you get, I think.
You're listening to The Fuse, the podcast of Confluence Concerts. My name is Larry Beckwith. I'm speaking with the brilliant Canadian guitarist, singer, producer, all-around great musician, Colin Linden. More of that interview in a few minutes. You heard Colin talking about his early studies of finger-picking technique and the old masters, particularly Reverend Gary Davis, who was one of the most influential guitarists of the 20th century, beginning his career in the 1930s and continuing as part of the folk music revival in the 60s. Here's a bit of the Cincinnati Flow Rag that Colin referenced a few minutes ago, as played by Reverend Gary Davis. An excerpt from the Cincinnati Flow Rag, played by Reverend Gary Davis. And now let's hear a bit of Colin Linden's guitar picking from his album South at 8, North at 9 from 1993. This is part of Gonna Get On My Feet After a While. Colin Linden, with the help of Bruce Coburn on that track, with part of the song Gonna Get On My Feet After a While, from his 1993 album South at 8, North at 9. You're listening to The Fuse, the podcast of Confluence Concerts. My name is Larry Beckwith. Now back to my conversation with the distinguished Canadian blues guitarist, songwriter, and producer, Colin Linden. I've been struck since I first met him by Colin's respect for and fascination with older musicians and his ability to support and lift them up as a quote-unquote sideman. I'm thinking in this context of his early work with Willie P. Bennett and members of the band. So I asked Colin if he himself felt that was a special gift of his.
Well, in a fundamental sense, I think being a good accompanist or being a good collaborator, producer, any of those things, part of the job. In fact, the giant part of the job is to, if you can, support what the music's about. So that's the fundamental raison d'être of doing it. Also, though, one thing that I realize as time goes on is that I'm more than almost anything else, I think I'm the product of being the youngest of three brothers. And you love your brothers so much, and you want them to be proud of you, and you want them to be happy that they let you hang out with them. Yeah. So that's a really, there is something about that in terms of the working with people who are a little older.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm the youngest of my generation, as opposed to the oldest of the generation younger than me.
Right. Right. That's interesting. Yeah. I just talking specifically about the band. I do remember I remember missing the time when you played with them around the, I guess it was around the Juno Awards or around, I remember that you telling me afterwards that that was an amazing night.
It was truly incredible. And Robbie
Yeah.
Robertson came to play with us, and it was very exciting. I mean, I had emulated or tried to emulate. I still try to emulate his playing. He's one
Yeah.
of my favorite players ever, not to mention all of the other amazing things he did as an artist. But hearing that tone coming out of the amplifier next to me, unforgettable. It was truly amazing.
Yeah.
And Rick and Garth were both so, and Lebon too, who wasn't there that night, but those guys were so good to me. They really, I mean, Rick brought me into the family and made me feel like I was family. I'll never forget it, of course, but I appreciate it more than words can say.
One event that I was present for was your night. I maybe it happened more than once, but there was a night at the Horseshoe with Rick Danko, just the two of you, I think. It kind of leads me to asking you about, another thing that I have admired so much, and also I feel like I connect to, is more than anything else, I find music can reflect great joy and also great sadness, more than words can in a way. And I remember that night thinking there is an element of sadness in those songs, in those band songs. And even in the way Rick Danko sang, I don't know, that just beautiful voice, it was almost like it was a cry for help or something.
I think he was somebody who felt things very deeply and very unselfconsciously. He was completely open-hearted in terms of his ability to, show emotion, show love, and he had a great deal of empathy. And he had seen a great deal of pain too. I mean, I think he had, even at that point, by the time that I met him, it was not that long after Richard Manuel had passed, and he was extremely close to Richard. I mean, I think more so, people talk about some other relationships within in the band, but I remember Rick's wife, Elizabeth, telling me, the same thing. People talk about, different relationships within the band, but the real closest friendship was between Rick and Richard. And I knew that that was something. And I remember one of the times that we had played the Horseshoe, Rick lost his son the week before.
Oh, gosh.
Earl came and played, and he played with great joy and great, he wasn't maudlin or anything like that. He was, and you knew that he must have really, there was all kinds of pain there, but he didn't focus on that. He definitely, he, you could really hear, you could hear it in his singing, no doubt.
Yeah, it's well, another thing I remember you saying at one point in one of our conversations was that struck me was about honesty in music making. It seemed to me at the time and probably now that the thing you respected almost more than anything else in music making was honesty and was it, that kind of true voice.
Well, I do think that the music that continues to live on over time, be it the band or be it Howlin' Wolf or the Everly Brothers or whatever you might be drawn to, Bob Dylan, of course. I think that's the thing that has the ability to really move you.
Yeah. You're listening to The Fuse, the podcast of Confluence Concerts. My name is Larry Beckwith, and it is a great joy to be speaking with Colin Linden on this episode of the program. We'll get back to the final portion of that conversation in a few minutes. I do want to remind you of Confluence Concerts' first program of the season, which takes place September 27th and 28th at Heliconian Hall, curated by Patricia O'Callaghan, and with performers Subha Shankaran, Mariam Toller, Greg O, Bijan Sapanji, Walid Abdulhamid, Mayri Demings, and yours truly. It's a program exploring the concept of the divine in music, and you'll hear works by Bach, Duriflay, Leonard Cohen, Bruce Coburn, Anne Southam, Horace Silver, Hildegard von Bingen, Willie P. Bennett, and others. We're having a wonderful time putting it together, and we warmly invite you to be part of it. Details are at www.confluenceconcerts.ca. We also have details there about the other concerts on our 2025-2026 season, including fabulous offerings from the Hibiki Project, cellist Peter Iom, Andrew Downing's Latvian Adventure, Centuries of Souls, Subha Shankaran's Mandala, The Impermanence of Being, and a raucous season ender curated by Teja Kasahara. Please join us for one concert or all of them. Now back to the final part of my conversation with the wonderful Canadian blues guitarist and producer Colin Linden. Colin is appearing on his own and with his band over two nights, October 10th and 11th, at Hugh's Room on Broadview Avenue. Two concerts that are bound to be very special indeed. I asked Colin about his own trajectory as a solo artist and why songwriting, recording, and performing his own material remains something very important to him.
Well, I mean, you know, it's in some ways it's the deepest root in terms of the most personal thing that you do, I think, is with writing. And it's been a real constant for me. In 19, I had written a lot of stuff by the time my third album came out, When the Spirit Comes, in 1988. And then I got signed to Warner Chappell for a publishing deal, and they sent me down to Nashville to co-write. And it was a really interesting experience, and it really opened my mind up to different ways of writing and different ways of looking at it. And initially it felt like this isn't something I do very naturally or anything like that. But eventually, even from that first trip down here, some stuff that I wrote became pretty successful. And it was a kind of a call to go ahead and do more of it. Mm-hmm. And it took a little while to take that thing, you know, that kind of, I wouldn't say more clinical approach, but just sort of, I guess, maybe more craft-oriented approach. It took a little while to marry that to what I was doing naturally. Mm-hmm. And it helped in a lot of ways. It helped unlock the door. And it's been an interesting thing because I work pretty regularly with some longtime amazing songwriters. I think especially of Bruce Coburn. Mm-hmm. And I think of Tom Wilson from Blackie and the Rodeo Kings, who is an incredible songwriter. And he's really, for rock and roll music, I think I can't think of a better Canadian songwriter than Tommy. Mm-hmm. And I also work really closely with T-Bone Burnett, who is a deep, deep, deep songwriter. Mm. And I've known T-Bone and been friends with him and worked with him for this year it'll be 34 years. And we made a record together for him that came out last year called The Other Side. And we worked really closely on the writing together. I mean, most of my role there was as a co-producer and collaborator, but we wrote a few of the songs together, and it was just incredible to see how excited he was about, like, he would show up every day and his computer would be open. He said, "This is what I wrote this morning. Check this out." So his enthusiasm and his focus on being impeccable, being inspired and impeccable, really impressed upon me how discreet his melodies are when he writes. Mm. and how classic and how beautifully put together. He wanted for the other side, for the album, he wanted to make every rhyme and he wanted there to be a note attached to every syllable, and he wanted every rhyme to fit perfectly.
Right.
He focused very much on that, and it was nothing but artful, but it was beautifully put together, beautifully crafted too, and it was very exciting. So every time that you're around someone who's like that, I think it can be really a great experience. It keeps you going.
Right.
And so you just try and keep, I think you try and keep the channels open, and you know that there are going to be some seasons where you're not going to, for me at least, where I'm not going to write as much, and then other seasons where it feels like the tap's there. So just show up, you know.
So do you write a lot in with your studio, or do you write intentionally, or are there times when you'll be doing something completely different and a song will just appear?
Both,
Yeah.
actually,
Yeah.
both. And it's still a mystery.
Right.
That's one thing that I find is pretty consistent when I speak to or read about or I'm in contact with any other songwriters. I think it's still, for my favorite ones at least, still kind of a mystery. I mean, you put in the work, you know, but it somewhere between sitting down with an empty page or whatever analogy you want to make for that, somewhere between that and the thing that you end up singing and playing, or somebody else ends up singing and playing or recording, there's something, there's mystery to it. There's something divine about it, I think. So.
Right. Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah, you mentioned Bruce Cockburn, who is, I know you have produced a number of his records. Is that
Ten
an
of them.
ongoing relationship that would you think we'll see more, or
If I have any say in the matter, yes.
great.
But I've done 10 albums for him, and every time that I get the call to do it, I'm thrilled, and I never ever expect that I'm going to get that call.
Right.
So I'm going to keep that in focus, but I love making records with Bruce.
I can imagine it's a great experience. He's such a profound writer, and also I'm sure that you connect on a guitar level as well, because people forget that, I guess, he's one of the great guitar players.
Oh yeah, he's one of the greatest fingerstyle guitar players in the world. I don't think that's hyperbole at all to say that. You know, over the, you know, 30, 34 years we've been working together, I've known him for quite a bit longer than that. I've known him since I was, but you know, as a fan, and he was very supportive of me really from my teens onward. But when he called me up just almost exactly 34 years ago, 34 years and a week or two ago, to help him put a band together to support the album that T-Bone produced called Nothing But a Burning Light, it was my, I don't think my life has changed any more than that from certainly any musical professional relationship. I treasure my friendship with Bruce above all of it. But yeah, man, he's great. I mean, the hardest, the biggest challenge about making a Bruce Cockburn record is making sure the damn red light's on. He's so incredibly prepared.
Right.
I mean, I sometimes, when I work with young artists, because you'll always want something to be spontaneous, you're open for that, of course, but there's that also just the sense of you want them to know their songs,
Yes.
you know, and Bruce is so prepared by the time that we record. I would say that of the 10 records that we've made, there's probably three songs that have overdubbed vocals,
Really?
and the rest of them are live, or primarily live,
Right.
just because he's so good.
Well, I was amazed. We went to see him last year in Massey Hall, and it was just him. And it was like a classical concert in a way. There is something about audiences in what did I see? There was some other show there later in the English Beat, and Squeeze played there.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was great, but so noisy. And so, the audience is kind of distracted all the time, and there's dancing and there are people talking all around you and everything. For Bruce's show, it was like being at a recital. And there was such a respectful, I don't know, sense of, maybe I'm overstating it by saying sense of awe in the place, but also there was a sense of an old master. Because it's a little, not shocking, but a little bit jarring to see him now, because it's difficult for him to get around. And
He has pretty bad arthritis in his back,
yeah
but aside from that, he's still
yeah
in fighting
yeah
form. And
but you do
so
get the sense, it's interesting you say about him being so prepared, because you do get the sense that he's
yeah, and even if that preparation prepares you to completely improvise what you do,
yes yeah
you know,
yeah Yeah.
those two things are not mutually exclusive. So I think about Bruce when you say a recital. He played at the Winnipeg Folk Festival a few weeks ago. I sat in for maybe four songs or something like that, but he mostly played by himself. And actually, the singer Nikki Mehta
Oh, yeah.
sang several songs with him too, which was
Right.
great. But he was so fantastic. And one of the songs he did was "Mama Just Wants the Barrel House All Night Long," from his album Night Vision from 1973. And good Lord, he played a solo on that that was just, I don't think I've ever heard anything better. You know, it was just stunning. And I mean, it was, you know, there were little bits and pieces of how he turns the chords, and I've heard him do it a lot of times. There were little bits and pieces of how he navigated the changes that were like signposts, that were things that he had done before. But all of what was in between those things was just massive phrasing, massive harmonic beauty and excitement and glorious, unexpected but soulful playing. It's just, how could you be better than that? I can't imagine anybody being better than
Right.
that. And I've heard of really a lot for a long time.
Yeah. Any kind of indication, or have you talked at all or planned at all what your set list is going to look like in October?
Well, I want to do different shows, of course, the two nights, because I'll be doing the first night solo. And I've been enjoying playing solo so much. And of course, playing with Johnny Diamond and Gary Craig. Gary and I have played together for 41 years now. And Johnny is still the new guy in the band at 34 years. So playing with them is just always a thrill. So sometimes when I do a show that, you know, like a show with the band, there'll be some songs that I'll want to do that are kind of more geared to what I do solo, just because they're most, you know, at the top of my mind. So there are going to be some things that I'm going to not do on the band night, just to focus on what Johnny and Gary and I do best. And same thing with the solo night. You know, there may be, I might call a friend or a family member to come and play a couple songs on the first night if I can, if
Lovely.
it well. But aside from that, I got a pretty good idea of what I want to be doing. So we'll see. I've been really playing. I've done a lot of shows. I've done, I think, 27 solo shows this year. I think that count is right. And I just I've been enjoying it so much. Most of them have been by myself, but Johnny and Gary and I have done we've done a few together as well. So and we always do something together. We did five Lacking the Rodeo Kings shows as
Right.
well. So, and you know, we play together a lot, and they came down and we made the core of what's going to be the new album down here a few months ago. So
Oh, I'm so glad there'll be a new album. That's great.
yeah, I don't know very much about the details about how and when it'll be released, but it's really close to being done now.
Nice.
So
Very nice.
hopefully.
Colin, it's so good to talk to you, and it will be great to hear you in October. I guess I have one last question, just about that maybe brings me back to the first question. Your connection to blues music and to the old masters. You mentioned Howlin' Wolf, and I know that you introduced me to Lonnie Johnson, which I often listen to Lonnie Johnson now too,
Good,
and
good way to spend your time.
it's great. Can you talk just a little bit about how that inspires you, and do you feel like these people are kind of walking with you in your journey as a musician?
I hope they are. I feel their presence. The ones that I knew personally, like the Wolf, and like Sam Chapman and Sonny Terry and Brian McGee and Muddy Waters a little bit, I knew, and the other people who I knew personally, and there were quite a few of them, really. Johnny Shines, Robert Pete Williams, Henry Townsend, Blind John Davis, of course. I feel some house. I feel their presence with me. I kind of, it comes down to the same thing where, when somebody has, shown their love and their kindness to you, that sticks with you, and it becomes part of who you are. You want to make them proud. You want to do their kindness justice, so that definitely is something that you feel. I mean, the guys in the band, of course, I feel that about. And you just feel like the whole path that you've been down leads you to that and helps you, I think, to be comfortable in your own skin. Definitely, I feel like even though I only played with them for one summer, playing with Bob Dylan was nothing would change you more than that. So these things you do bring with you, and I think the older you get, and when some of the older masters, or well, most of the older masters in my case, who I knew, are gone, and you feel like it's sort of your job to tell people about them, either by talking about them or by having it in the playing.
Well, Colin, thank you so much for this. It's great to talk to you. I could talk to you all day.
It's
And
great talking with you, Larry. Thank you for hanging with me all 40 years. It's great to know you for this amount of time.
been my pleasure, and I hope it continues for many years to come.
Thanks. Me too. Me too. And look forward to seeing you in a few weeks, just a few weeks now.
Me too. Yeah.
Okay. See you, Larry.
See you
Thanks.
soon. Bye.
Okay, yeah. Bye-bye.
Colin Linden, what a treasure. Colin will be playing and singing at Hughes Room on October 10th and 11th. For more information and tickets, please visit hughesroomlive.com, and I'll hope to see you there. That's all for this episode of The Fuse, the podcast of Confluence Concerts. On the next program, I will speak with my colleague Patricia O'Callaghan about her upcoming show for Confluence, What is Divine? At Heliconian Hall on September 27th and 28th. In the meantime, I hope you will get out and support the amazingly rich and diverse live music scene in Toronto. My name is Larry Beckwith. Bye for now.